Okay, so hello, this is Amy Keegan Sofronic. I am here, it is June 24th, 2025. We're in Hudson, New York, and as a part of Oral History Summer School, I get the privilege and honor to be sitting here with Emma York. I know Emma, I've known Emma for 4 days, so we are pretty new to each other, and I just want to pass it to you, Emma, to say your name and introduce yourself in whatever ways feel right to you.
Thank you for creating the space and so generously thinking about my needs and comfort levels. It's much appreciated. My name is Emma York. I am a participant in Oral History Summer School 2025, which has felt like such a gift. And wow, I'm already getting emotional, which is hilarious. I began a gratitude practice at the beginning of this year because I've just really wanted to document this sort of pivotal or transformational moment in my personal life, but also in the larger political landscape. Archivally minded person over here. And so I was doing my gratitude practice each night of this oral history summer school and just cumulatively feeling so much gratitude to be surrounded by so many brilliant and deeply compassionate and caring and intentional people and to learn in this space and also sort of affirmed in taking some leaps in my life that have allowed me to be here.
That's a really beautiful start.
And I'm feeling emotional today. Not entirely sure why, so this will be fun.
It's all welcome here.
Thank you.
And I hope we can create a space where that feels true for you. So,
thank you.
Well, Emma, maybe I can offer a question and we can follow it to the degree that feels good to you. I am endlessly curious about you, and so maybe we could start with just, would you be interested in sharing a little bit about who you were when you were a younger person?
Well, someone once asked me, or recently asked me if I was a precocious child, and then I proceeded to share several anecdotes, and we both co-determined that I was indeed a precocious child, so both internally and externally recognized in that way. I think I was a really curious, inquisitive kid, and still am a very curious, inquisitive adult. And I think that that was really nurtured in ways that I now understand are very rare by my parents, who never really cared about grades or following a very linear and predictable trajectory in life, I guess. Maybe that's because neither of them did that. So my dad was a traditional wooden boat builder, and my mom was the folklorist who decided to create a festival, so not even doing folklore in the way that most folklorists choose to do it, and then started her own nonprofit. I think I've been really lucky to see models of what it looks like to follow your passion, your desires, your interests, and to do things with deep intention and in community with other people, maybe a niche community with other people. I feel like very, very lucky that my curiosity has been nurtured. And I think as a kid, I went through pretty much every form of schooling that you can, which has offered me a lot of different perspectives. I guess I feel like I've lived at the intersection of a lot of identities, experiences, and communities. And so maybe that's why I've also taken a listening posture, is this feeling of never quite belonging anywhere, but also belonging everywhere, and being really interested in other people who feel similarly. And I guess more recently I've been thinking about maybe how that's tied to my mom's side of the family, being part of the Jewish diaspora. But yeah, so I guess backing up, because I've gone on several pathways and that's sort of how my brain works, and it makes sense to me and it doesn't always make sense to other people. I attended like a Jewish preschool and then this really funky hippie private school and then an urban public school district and then a charter public school and then an urban public school and then an elite liberal arts college. And so I think because in my family and also probably in the hippy-dippy private school that I went to for maybe like the first 2 years of formal schooling, my curiosity was really supported and learning was thought of as so expansive and experiential. When I was entering into urban public school district as a second grader, I felt like something was wrong, systemically wrong. I don't know that at the time, at whatever, 7, 8 years old, I had the language to understand that. But I think I have been really interested in ensuring that everyone in my community and in the world more broadly, although maybe I can't do that by myself, is afforded the beautiful opportunity to be curious, to be soft, to live the fullest expression of their humanity. And so that has led me to do lots of different things and all kind of with a aim of being a conduit, like someone who is using connection to redistribute power. And I don't know that I found exactly like a salary benefited job that allows me to do that perfectly, but I've intentionally entered into different spaces and jobs where I knew I would be able to finesse that or make that happen. And so that led me to education, to my, you're gonna have so many things to think about from this, so feel free to cut me off at any point in time. Yeah, so I think I was maybe politicized, radicalized, or like led onto this path around education and the transformative space of education because I attended a large urban public school for high school that was under threat of state receivership, which is a system that is challenged and challenging because it's very reliant on quantitative data like test scores that we know is often correlated with class and race and not always with the learning that's happening in the building or not capturing all the learning that's happening in the building. But it was a school with a high dropout rate and high absenteeism rate and low test scores generally. And so the state had the district create a turnaround plan. And as part of that turnaround plan, they wanted to have student input, because it looks bad if you don't have student input. Not, in my opinion, because they really wanted the student input, but because it looked good on paper to say. And there was student input and some teacher input too. It wasn't all top down, which is often the perception and the reality of what a state takeover looks like. So I became part of this group of young people who were galvanized to kind of think about what do the young people want? What do your teachers want? And how can you advocate for that and make that known to decision makers and the powers that be? And so it maybe led me to start to think about my personal experiences and the experiences of my peers in a more systemic way. And so then I went off to Williams College, a baby first year, and I was academically challenged maybe for the first time in my life. And I was really excited by that, excited to be in a community of learners, and sort of stumbled. My advisor for some reason was like out or MIA. And so I was sort of choosing classes on my own, and I stumbled into Professor Joy Jane's 300 level Africana Studies political theory course. I was the only first year, there was one other second year, and predominantly seniors, and so that should have probably been an indicator that there was a reason it was like level 300, that meant something that I didn't really conceptualize, and there was no advisor to tell me otherwise. And for some reason, Professor Joy James thought, it's totally fine that this person has no prereqs, we'll make it work. And I'm so glad that I struggled through that class, because it really opened me up to understand hidden history and the ways in which a lot of what I had been taught in my K through 12 education was an incomplete story, and a story that had left me with so many questions about why my city and my school and my community were experiencing what maybe I then came to understand as like racial capitalism. But didn't have language for. And so I started to feel already really frustrated in that class with learning all of this, but then feeling like, now what? How are we materially changing these conditions? Feels like we're just talking about them and writing about them. And I remember having a really long one-on-one conversation with Professor Joy James about this. And so she ended up connecting me, and I'm really, really grateful for this, with Professor Ed Upping, who was an art professor whose father had been incarcerated, and he was really interested in using art to think about the carceral state. And so I was a research assistant for him that summer. And so again, I'm like getting more and more deeply embedded in understanding the structures and systems that are informing life. Life that I've witnessed, life that's meaningful to my loved ones. And I'm also feeling like, why am I privy to this information? Because I stuck it through and had parents who allowed me to form the questions to make K through 12 education interesting enough for me to stick around. Why am I having access to this at this elite liberal arts college? And so many people drop out because they never see themselves in the curriculum. And not just the curriculum, they never see themselves represented as agents of change or elements within the larger historical narrative. And suddenly I'm learning about the Black Panther Party, and I'm learning there was a branch in my home city, and that's never talked about, that we're only talking about the history of whaling and a little bit about the history of the Underground Railroad and abolition, but in ways that maybe feel safe for the general public because it's cordoned off in the past. And I felt like one way in which I could help support the changes in the world that I wanted to see was to facilitate that kind of learning for people in a K through 12 setting, which I felt like had less barriers than a post-secondary setting where people are opting in a certain way and have already like overcome a bunch of hurdles. And so then I graduated and became an AmeriCorps, for the record, a program which is being fully defunded right now. And I ended up at this little independent tuition-free school for low-income girls called Our Sisters School in New Bedford, Mass., which is where I'm from. And I then went on to get my Master's of Arts in Teaching and came back and taught 7th and 8th grade humanities there, and and now I have transitioned out of the classroom and into a role at a performing arts center, also in New Bedford, Massachusetts, doing public programming as an associate director of education and community. And we can talk about reasons for that transition if that's of interest to you or me. I'm gonna turn it back to you because I'm curious what has resonated or sparked your interest.
Thanks, Emma. I really am loving, and I'm really hearing the way you followed your curiosity as you talked about from being a very young person. That feels like a very real thread. But I also hear a real thread of like deep empathy. And I'm wondering where you think that empathy comes from.
Ooh. What a good question. I think I would define myself that way, and definitely many, many people in my life externally have defined me that way. There's a story from my family or from my childhood where my little brother Isaac, who's about 3.5 years younger than me, was swinging on the swings outside in our backyard and jumped off and broke his arm. And it was, it looked like where your wrist would bend with your arm, but not in the part where your wrist is. And luckily we lived right next to the hospital, and so my whole family rushed him over to the hospital where I was born, St. Luke's Hospital. And I ended up having to go into the bathroom because I was having such an emotional response to being around so much pain and suffering, and maybe also a little bit like auditory and visual stimulation. And so I remember, I was little at the time, but I remember my mom and dad had to actually call like a distant cousin relative to come pick me up and transport me elsewhere, because they wanted to obviously focus their attention and energy and needed to focus their attention and energy on my brother and his recovery. And I was having such a visceral reaction. And I think that was a time in which I really had no barriers or boundaries or like safety nets that I'd created for myself around feeling with others, feeling through others. And I think I have worked on that throughout my life. Often people have said, like, you would make a great therapist or a great social worker. And I've said, I really want to direct those skill sets and energies in different ways and towards my immediate circle of loved ones and through like oral history and curriculum design and teaching. And I think that's maybe been like a mechanism to say, like, this is a part of me and it can't be all of me. And maybe the world would like it to be all of me. It's interesting, my like the etymology of my name is sometimes associated with like mother of the universe. And so I think also around gender, it's been interesting for me to think about like how much of this empathy is a quality of me that is inherent, if there's such a thing, to me, and how much is something I've been socialized into by watching other women in my life be mediators, facilitators, connectors, listeners. And ultimately, I kind of threw, that was a quandary that was like consuming me for a little bit when I was in undergrad, and I've kind of thrown that out the window and decided, like, you know what, actually, I'm sure it's a mixture of all of it, and it doesn't really matter. It really matters, like, what are the parts of who I am, regardless of where I've received or grown them, that I want to hold on to, and in what ways. And so I have decided that empathy is something I think is really important. More people should be practicing it. And that I'm really proud to hold onto in a variety of ways. And I think I've been thinking about how important it is to, I don't know how to phrase this, to live for myself. Yeah, and I think there, I had
a partner who lovingly called me out, and I really appreciate it. And whenever I'm in my head about this, I think about what he said, which is like,
sometimes when you're a very empathetic person, it feels like really hard to say no, to extract yourself from a situation, even if you know that that's what's necessary. And I think I felt like an immense guilt leaving the classroom, leaving teaching, even though I left at the end of the year and I had built all of this sort of aftercare plan for the curriculum I created for my students, and I'm still in contact with them, and I'm still in contact with the school and the teacher who's taken over. There was still this immense guilt around like leaving a caring profession, especially when caring is a big part of your identity. And I've been thinking about that a lot with people who are part of values-driven work in nonprofit spaces, in nursing, in education, which can also tend to be like feminized spaces, whether that's right or wrong. So this partner was often like helping me by being like, okay, like the world is not gonna fall apart if you leave. Like, and why are you so self-centered to think that that the world revolves around you? And I think it actually is a really loving reframe of the ways in which often we're taught like this big dividing line between selfish and selfless behavior. And I think it's a lot murkier than that. And I think I've realized it's really important to, yes, acknowledge the impact that you can make on the world, the communities that are connected to you, but also to recognize that like people are resilient, people have agency. Also, if a situation is going to blow up when you leave, that situation or institution was not sustainable in the first place, and maybe that collapse is necessary in certain ways to reimagine the situation or the space in a way that actually is sustainable and generative for not just you and the people there now, but many generations into the future. Yeah, so I've been really, side note, I've been really interested in collapse and, yeah, disintegration, failure, and breakage recently.